Quiet, please.
Ladies and gentlemen.
You ready for the big show?
In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Lars. This is the Lars Larson Show.
President Trump is one badass president. He secured the border at a level we've never seen before.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
For our country and for our children, the best is yet to come.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
He is an existential threat to democracy.
Here's your host.
Quiet, please.
Lars Larson.
Yes, this is being investigated as a quintuple homicide. Five people deceased. Yeah.
That is Detective Shannon Wild of the Washington County Sheriff's Department talking about a very strange homicide that happened over the weekend. At least that's as much as we know about it now. The discovery of the mass killing was made Saturday morning at a rural property in unincorporated Washington County. That's near Forest Grove. Let me dig into the details of that in just a moment. What we know about it and what we do not know about it yet. But first, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. If you want to join the best conversation and talk journalism, it's here every day at 866 Hey Lars, and glad to have you with me on the Radio Northwest Network, where we endeavor to serve the Pacific Northwest states of Oregon, Washington, and Idaho with honestly provocative talk on a daily basis. You can also send emails to talk@larslarson.com, and our X poll question, which I'll get into later, you can find that at Lars Larson Show and at larslarson.com, and brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at ultimatetruckservice.com. But let me get back to the homicide that happened. This is five people found dead, and the suspect, who was then fleeing after the discovery on Saturday morning, was apparently found having taken his own life on Sunday in Enumclaw, Washington. Now, you say, well, what happened? That's the question. We really don't know what happened, and it sounds like the police may not know what happened either. They held a press conference. The press conference was held, even though the discovery of the bodies was about 5:30 on Saturday morning, the police held a press conference yesterday, and they told what they did know, but they also said, we need to have the community's help in figuring out what happened here. This is Sheriff Caprice Massey talking about that.
I will say that in my 22 years here, I have not been a part of or witnessed a scene quite this complex involving this type of an investigation. And I'm just going to lead in and say that I recognize that this incident is deeply concerning to our community.
Yeah, no kidding, deeply concerning. But the problem is, the biggest reason for concern is that you have absolutely no idea what it was that happened. Was this a drug deal gone wrong? Don't have any indication of that. Was this somebody who apparently had lived at the property? The police do say that Benjamin Charles Parker, a 36-year-old man, found dead by suicide in Enumclaw. He was found inside a vehicle, even though the sheriff's office said we suspect that he may have lived at this property at some point, but it sounds like they don't actually know what happened or why it happened. Here's what happened first. They got a call of a vehicle that was on fire around 5:30. This is on Saturday morning. Now, remember, the police held their press conference late on Sunday afternoon. And when the fire department showed up for that car fire, they found a car on fire and they found dead bodies. It turns out a total of five of them. Were they inside the car? The sheriff's department won't say. What were the circumstances? They won't say. They did say that they found a number of dead animals as well, although they won't share the circumstances. Officials have not released the names, gender, or ages of the people who died, not at this hour, and they have not shared details about the cause of death. Again, Sheriff Caprice Massey asking for the public's help, something I haven't heard very often at all from police agencies, but listen to this.
Investigators would love to talk with anyone familiar with this residence or the people that live there. There are no details too small. You can contact our non-emergency number at 503-629-0111, but our investigators are going to ask that anyone with any available information please contact us so that we can work to to make sure that our community is safe.
Now, does that sound like the police agencies really don't have the first clue as to what might have happened? They might know cause of death. I would imagine that the autopsy that will be done on the five who died, and there would be autopsies done in a situation like this, it would tell you something about that. They also know that Benjamin Parker found dead inside his car in Enumclaw, Washington. They have already indicated that it is believed he died by suicide, and the detectives say they don't believe there's any danger to the public at this point. But they did find, and this is according to the ABC affiliate KATU, they found it is likely that this Benjamin Parker lived at the property in Hillside, this is in Washington County, with four other people. They did not find a criminal history for Parker in the state of Oregon. He had a minor criminal record from Rhode Island for driving with a suspended license about a year ago and allegedly possessing a stolen motor vehicle part or parts about a dozen years ago. The investigation is still going on. And I've reached out to the Washington County Sheriff's Department and said to them, if you want to come on the program and talk to the audience that we've got throughout Oregon, Washington, and Idaho, we have about 1 million people who listen to this show on a weekly basis. We'd be glad to get the word out to them to say, do you know anything about these people? I mean, part of the problem is we only know where they live. Do we know their names? We don't. Ages? Don't know. Benjamin Parker, we know his name because Benjamin Charles Parker, 36, was found dead by apparently suicide in Enumclaw. Other than that, you don't know much about it, which kind of tells you that this may be one of those situations where the police are, well, they're looking for some way to find out what it was that happened sometime either late on Friday night or early on Saturday morning that ended up with five people dead, a car on fire, animals killed in some fashion, and the man who they suspect did it on the run and fleeing all the way to Enumclaw. So I'll make the same invitation to you. If you want to call the Sheriff's Department in Washington County, I'd invite you to do it. Help them figure out exactly what happened. If you want to call this show and give us some legitimate information about what happened, we would invite that as well. Glad to get your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. And our X poll question, this is going to sound kind of odd. Should America follow Portugal's lead and ban face coverings in public? The country of Portugal has now enacted a measure coming straight from the president of Portugal, that's Antonio José Seguro, that largely prohibits individuals from covering their faces while in public. So what we're talking about is hijabs and burqas. They have said that other than those required by some medical necessity, that it will become illegal to hide a person's face or block identification in public areas, and bans require people to cloak their faces due to gender, religion, age, or origin. They are not going to do this. They're talking about fines of €150 to €3,000 if people violate that ban on face coverings in public. Should America follow Portugal's lead? Not the worst idea in the world. Today's X Poll is brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network. Climbing in high credit.
Forever hold your peace. 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-HEY-LARS. Now, back to the Lars Larson Show.
That makes a lot of sense. A lot of nonsense.
Right. You're bloody well right. You know you got a right to sit.
This is the Northwest Nonsense.
How much longer do we have to sit for this nonsense?
That great moment every day where Lars brings you the cold, hard facts without any liberal wokeness from the Daily Dead fish wrapper or mainstream media bias.
You know, almost one-third of the people in Oregon and Washington depend on Medicaid for their health insurance. Now, Congress created Medicaid for the poor. That number might surprise you. How in the world are there so many supposedly poor people in prosperous states like the Pacific Northwest states? Here's the secret. The Medicaid rolls in Oregon and Washington contain a lot of illegal aliens. Even though Congress specifically excluded them from the program, Oregon and Washington decided to cover them anyway. They also include a lot of what I consider are citizen deadbeats. Let me define deadbeat for you, because I'm sure I'll get some blowback for that. A working age person with no mental or physical disabilities and no young children at home. Should that be a working person? So why are they on Medicaid and off the job? And that is because bleeding heart liberals allow them and then pay their medical insurance from taxes on hardworking non-deadbeat citizens like you and me. Congress and President Trump changed the rules. If you're working age and you're not disabled and you have no small kids to care for at home, then you either work 20 hours a week, it's fairly modest, or even volunteer 20 hours a week, or you lose your Medicaid. It seems fair to me that legacy news media like the Daily Dead Fish Wrapper, OregonLive.com, are clutching their pearls and wailing at the unfairness of expecting able-bodied citizens to pay their own way. Glad to get your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. Our question of the day, which is brought to you by Multnomah Medical Clinic. No pills, no shots, no surgery. Fix what's really causing the problem at Multnomah Medical Clinic. Brent writes in, Lars, should the U.S. Forest Service return to an aggressive suppression policy similar to the old 10 a.m. rule, where the objective was that if you have a wildfire by 10 a.m. the day after it was reported, or continue to use managed wildfire as a land management tool? When a fire starts, it is an emergency, but is then deliberately managed rather than immediately suppressed. What does that decision ultimately cost taxpayers in extended firefighting, damaged infrastructure, rehabilitation, and other downstream expenses? More importantly, are we actually saving money and improving forest health by managing these fires, or would aggressive early suppression combined with planned fuels reduction be safer and more fiscally responsible? With $10.8 billion in deferred maintenance, I'd be interested to hear what Lars and his listeners think about this. Signed, Brent. Well, Brent, my attitude is you shouldn't let forests go up in flames. You shouldn't let them be burned over. And yet that has been the approach of both the BLM and the Forest Service for decades. I think we ought to save those forests and preserve them for the value that they hold. And now today's Daily Grill.
Insane.
Are you completely insane?
Ridiculous.
They get more and more ridiculous.
Flat out dumb.
You're even dumber than I thought.
Who deserves today's Lars Grill of the Day?
Maybe they're just really, really stupid.
Presented by Oregon City Garage Door.
The whole idea of getting rid of roadless areas, because the roadless areas, so-called, this is a problem that people defend when they do not understand it. As our friend Brent points out, at least 45.8 million disabled Americans now will have the opportunity to use these areas if they are no longer considered roadless. That's more than the entire population of Canada, if you want to get a perspective. It's a 2001 rule that stopped meaningful access for all disabled Americans. It is fantastic to see us get rid of the so-called roadless areas. The trickle-down will start to solve most major complaints and issues, and I think that's a great thing to do. Keeping roadless areas, when you're trying to make sure that you don't have forest fires that are destroying rangeland and forests in America, I think it makes no sense to maintain areas that are difficult to get into for firefighting and for disabled people, about 45 million of them. You're effectively locking them out of what you still call public lands. How much can it be public land if the public is not allowed to access it and the disabled public is certainly locked out at the schoolhouse door? Glad to have you on board. If you want to join the best conversation in talk journalism, it's here every day at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarsen.com. Our ex-poll question, should America follow Portugal's lead and ban face coverings in public? I would vote yes on that one. You can find the question at Lars Larsen Show and at LarsLarsen.com, and brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at Ultimate Truck Services. Service.com. And then you have to consider what is going on in Seattle right now. You've got a brand new mayor of the city of Seattle. She was not much to write home about even when she came into office. And now that she's been in office for a period of time, the public is starting to see just how completely inadequate Katie Wilson is at doing the job of mayor. Which shouldn't be a gigantic surprise, because Katie Wilson came into that job with no history of an ability to even take care of herself. Katie Wilson is a married woman. She has a child. She has a husband. She doesn't work a job and hasn't worked a job. Her husband doesn't work a job and he doesn't have a job. They have a child, and the child is cared for in child care, all of which is paid for by Katie Wilson's mom and dad. So they did a poll, and the results were released last Thursday, and they show that her early popularity of 57% is dropping very, very sharply. Between April and last week, the popularity of Katie Wilson as the mayor of Seattle dropped from 57% to about 37%. That was the poll that was done through the early part of August. It came from Fulcrum Strategy Group. They have said a 20% drop in favorability is almost entirely because of public safety issues. And that is, the public in Seattle does not feel safe, and they think that Katie Wilson is largely to blame for that. And I'd have to agree with them. Coming up in a moment, Oregon's Measure 114 that would ban almost all citizens from buying guns has been tied up in court for years. But could a final decision now be just days away? We're going to talk to one of the attorneys involved coming up
next. The Lars Larsen Show. Portland's News. Have something to say but don't want to talk? Email Lars at talk@LarsLarsen.com. Now, back to the Lars Larsen Show.
Hey, welcome back to the Lars Larsen Show. It's Monday. It's the Radio Northwest Network, and there is a decision that is coming. We just don't know when it's coming from the Oregon Supreme Court. But there is some math that suggests it could be literally almost any day now. It involves Oregon's Measure 114, which was, just to remind you, effectively a ban on all citizens buying guns in the state of Oregon. And if you say, well, but you can't do that, that would violate the Second Amendment of the Constitution. Only Measure 114 is being decided not based on the Second Amendment, although there are some cases involving that. It's being decided on whether or not it violates the state constitution, which I think it does. So it's up to the Oregon Supreme Court to decide, and the math is suggesting they could be doing that almost any minute now. I wanted to talk to Tony Aiello, who's a civil rights attorney and was involved in this with Tyler Smith and Associates. Tony, welcome back to the program.
Hi there, Lars. Thanks for having me.
Glad to do it. Is there, now I've suggested that Measure 114 is effectively a ban on citizens being able to buy guns. If you think I've overstated that, tell my audience what your conclusion is about what Measure 114, if it goes into effect, is going to do to the average citizen's ability to buy a pistol or a rifle.
No, I completely agree. It bans most popular firearms, the most commonly used and technologically current firearms. And then on top of that, it requires a permit to purchase, which will make it difficult to impossible, not to mention expensive, for Oregonians to acquire firearms.
Well, and in fact, when you say the permit, what does it take to get the permit? Because haven't they set up a bit of a catch-22 saying you have to have a permit, but law enforcement doesn't necessarily have to allow you to get the permit?
Exactly. Local law enforcement is going to be the ones charged with enforcing the permit provision, and not all of them have the resources or the desire to stand up such a program.
So if the local law enforcement say, yeah, you have to have a permit to buy a gun, you have to take a class to be able to get the permit, but we're not going to offer the class, nor are we going to sign off on letting anybody else offer the class, they could effectively ban the purchase of all guns by law-abiding citizens. I mean, the criminals will still be buying guns, but law-abiding citizens will be locked up, right?
Exactly, exactly. And that's more lawsuits and more money to pursue compelling them to set up a program if money could be made available.
Okay, so now let's get to this. Why does the math, and I'll say it that way, I don't think it's the way you said it, but does the math about the calendar suggest that the Oregon Supreme Court may be coming out with a decision almost any day now?
Yeah, so popular wisdom amongst attorneys is it takes 9 to 12 months in order for the Oregon Supreme Court to put out an opinion. We're just now over the 9-month mark, but the most recent case they decided was decided on July 30th, and that was about 10 months after oral argument. So we sit here now, today, a little bit over 9.5 months from oral argument. So it could come out any one of these Thursdays or Fridays coming up, or even after Election Day.
Now, tell me this. Is there any possibility? I mean, I guess there's always the possibility. Is it likely that the Oregon Supreme Court, being a political animal, because all the court justices were named by Democrat governors, is it possible that they will say, then we're going to hold this off until after the November election?
It's possible. They don't have any strict timeline. They have to decide cases. But, you know, our hope right now is that they decide it before the election, so Oregonians go into it knowing who's going to be there, knowing the status of their rights before they vote for governor.
Okay, and even if they do decide Measure 114 and declare it constitutional, I would find that hard to believe because I've read Section 27. I don't think it's constitutional under the state constitution. But even if they do that, does Measure 114 stay on hold until 2028 anyway? And if so, why?
Yes, so House Bill 4145 passed during the short session due to a lot of great work by our Senate Republicans and a good friend of mine, Derek LeBlanc. It postponed any enforcement of ballot measure 114 until 2028, but the legislature will be going back into a long session early next year in 2027. So it's very important we've got a governor in office that will veto any attempt to implement Measure 114 sooner.
Okay, because if Christine Drazen wins as the Republican candidate for governor, and she wins against Tina Kotek, who's, you know, not been doing that well, she's been abandoned by many of her biggest supporters in the labor unions. But if Drazen wins, Drazen could then veto anything the Oregon legislature passes that would put Measure 114 into effect, right?
Exactly, and she's got the line item veto power, and she's made it very clear to me and many others what her intentions are with regard to Measure 114, any unconstitutional gun restrictions, and then also, you know, the hunting stuff that has been coming out. I think the outdoorsman's and gun owners' governor candidate, regardless of party, in 2026.
Is Tina Kotek even bothering to talk about those issues, or has she been asked? Do you know?
No, and I don't think she has the basic knowledge enough to speak about them with any sort of intelligence. I've heard her talk about guns before, and it didn't go very well.
Yeah, because she doesn't know what she's talking about on the subject of guns?
Exactly. Yeah, she referred to Measure 114 as an automatic firearm ban, which it very clearly is not, to even the untrained reader.
No, it's not, although it could effectively keep people from buying guns, but it only keep the law-abiding from buying guns. The criminals will still be able to buy guns. And I guess what I wish some of the reporters would do, because I don't have access to Governor Kotek. She's been asked to come on this show. She is not She has declined to come on this show any number of times. I'd love to ask her, read the wording of Section 27 of the state constitution and ask her whether she agrees that citizens have a right to buy guns under Section 27 of the Oregon Constitution. And if she agrees they do, then say, then how can you justify Measure 114 that effectively takes that away? But I suspect most reporters who have access to Governor Kotek are going to go anywhere near that kind of question.
No, instead they just talk about firearm violence and suicide and refer to the Constitution very disparagingly as an antiquated document that really only has the meaning that the party ascribed to it.
And by the way, Tony, my latest favorite number is that more people have died in France this year because the government bans air conditioning than have died in every single mass shooting in all of American history added up together. That the French government has many, you know, and so when you talk about boiling a frog, apparently the French government has figured out an effective way to boil frogs, and they have a record number of deaths, and it makes the deaths in America from every single mass shooting in history pale by comparison to the air conditioning deaths in France in 1 year. You've got the Lars Larson Show. A parking lot in
on the go. Can't listen to Lars live? No problem. Get the podcast 24/7 at LarsLarson.com. Now, more with Lars Larson.
Hey, welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. I'm glad to get to your phone calls and emails. It's a Monday, and it's the Radio Northwest Network. And this segment of the show is brought to you by eLegacy. I just got an email about eLegacy a moment ago from a gentleman who said, is that the organization you're talking about? It absolutely is. You've spent your whole life building up your wealth. Don't leave it unprotected. Set your kids up for success by creating a customized estate plan with eLegacy. Go to eLegacyLars.com and set up a complimentary consultation. That's eLegacyLars.com. And I might mention this. Tina and I decided to create one of those plans long before I ever began to do ads for them on the radio. And it was only because they said, oh, you do radio. Maybe you could spread the word about what it is that we do. And then I began doing their ads. So I was sold on their service a long time before that. It's eLegacyLars.com. Our X-Poll question today, should America follow Portugal's lead and ban face coverings in public? Here's the way it's being reported that the Portuguese President Antonio José Seguro has enacted a measure that largely prohibits individuals from covering their faces while in public, a restriction broadly viewed as aimed at Muslim women. No kidding. The law bans sporting coverings meant to hide a person's face or block identification in public areas and bans anybody requiring somebody to cloak their face due to gender, religion, age, or origin. Those who fail to comply could be slapped with fines of 150 euros to 3,000 euros. For the President of the Republic, the uncovered face constitutes a structural dimension of social trust, a characteristic of Portuguese society, according to an English language translation of the Portuguese language press release. And to admit that women, and only women, must hide their entire faces implies an asymmetry that is incompatible with the values of parity and equal dignity between men and women, values that shape European democracies. Now, could you get away with that kind of limitation in the United States of America? I suspect you could not, because of the First Amendment to the Constitution that recognizes that you have God-given rights both to free expression and to be able to choose how you want to express yourself. I suspect that the First Amendment would prevent that kind of law, the kind that they have put in place in Portugal. However, I think that is not a bad idea to suggest that if you have a religion like Islam that has decided that women must cover their faces while in public, I don't think that is compatible with the kind of society that we live in. So, our X-Poll question, should America follow Portugal's lead and ban face coverings in public? My answer to that would be an honest yes. We should do that. It's brought to you today by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at ultimatetruckservice.com. Now, is King County wasting taxpayer dollars spying on ICE? That's the question I'd like you to consider. I mean, I'm not sure that Multnomah County isn't doing the same kind of thing or other counties around the Pacific Northwest, but King County has taken an additional step. They have hired a full-time person to do nothing but monitor flights that are operated by ICE. Boeing Field hired a flight monitoring and outreach coordinator to observe and log federal ICE deportation flights on county property. That's because Boeing Field is owned by King County. Now, about 7-8 years ago, the former county executive, Dow Constein, issued an executive order attempting to ban ICE deportation flights from Boeing Field altogether. But 4 years later, the federal court said, you can't do that. They said local governments do not have the authority to restrict or interfere with a federal agency's operation or federal airspace functions. Unable to block the charter operations, county officials have pivoted toward tracking, documenting, and publishing the activity. The public log recorded 285 detainees moving through the airfield across five different flights in the weeks of August. The creation of a full-time position has drawn scrutiny from critics who characterize the job as a wasteful, taxpayer-funded effort aimed at harassing federal law enforcement. I couldn't agree with them more. This is what's going on. The Pacific Northwest benefits from what ICE is doing. ICE is arresting illegal aliens who are, in most cases, also criminals, either accused criminals or, criminals who have not yet been to court. And the fact is, we should be able to control, you know, what the local government is doing, but the local government should not be able to control what ICE is doing. It makes no sense at all. And in fact, we've had Supreme Court cases before involving states like Arizona that tried to step in and do the federal immigration role. They can't do it. It is unconstitutional. And King County is operating in the same fashion, and they should knock it off. Try to get your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. You can vote in our poll on X. You'll find the question every day at Lars Larson Show. And on that note, let's go to Eric, who's a naysayer. Hey, Eric, what do you and I disagree about that makes you a naysayer?
Hi, Lars. I've called you before. I'm just a timber puller, but my dad was MRT and SWAT team for the state police.
Yeah.
And when they did, like, their deal, they didn't go into buildings with masks on. Now, and if they can wear masks, then I suppose a Muslim woman can wear a mask. That's all I figure.
Okay, now hold on, because the law enforcement is wearing the mask not out of a religious practice, but is wearing the mask out of practical considerations like use of tear gas or to protect your eyes from flying shrapnel. But they're wearing it for a private, for a purpose like that. But when it comes to a religion that says we must have people cover their faces in public, you're okay with that?
I don't agree with everything with the Muslim religion. There's a lot that's bunk.
Do you agree with anything they do?
Not
and if
much.
So, tell me what it is, because I'm curious.
Agents to go out there, and they're worried about their family getting doxxed. When my dad would do raids, I got jumped by the kids that my dad busted their houses. It's just the way it worked.
In that case, I think there's a practical reason for having a face covering. When it comes to a religion like that, I think that is incompatible with American society, but I appreciate a good naysayer call. You're listening to the Radio Northwest Network and the Lars Larson Show.
The Lars Larson Show. FM News 101.
8 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Live. This is the Lars Larson Show.
President Trump is one badass president. He secured the border at a level we've never seen before.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
For our country and for our children, the best is yet to come.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And
Lars.
Now.
He is an existential threat to democracy.
Here's your host.
Quiet, please.
Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you on a Monday. We're live on the Radio Northwest Network, and I want to bring this subject up in front of you because I will admit I have a dog in the fight. I like beef. In fact, I like to have it for dinner at least maybe a couple of three times a week, if not more often than that. But Washington State's biggest beef plant just went up for sale. Did state red tape just kill a big chunk of the region's food supply? I thought we'd check in with Jack Field. Jack joins us now, and Jack is the executive director of the Washington Cattle Feeders Association. Jack, welcome to the program.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Lars. Thank you for having me.
Tell me about this news that, you know, we've got beef processing facilities and beef feeding facilities that are simply going up for sale. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean they're going to go away, but where do we stand as a region right now, and are we letting state red tape and taxes drive some of the biggest, most important producers of food in the Northwest out of the region?
Well, that's you've asked a very timely and complex question. The announcement that came out a little over a week ago regarding the Tyson Fresh Meats plant in Wallula, Washington, in Walla Walla County, that announcement that the plant is being placed up for sale was coupled with an even broader statement that Tyson had put out closing a plant in Joslyn, Illinois, as well as a case-ready facility in Utah. So when you look at that, the other shoe that fell was the announcement that the Tyson Fresh Meats plant that processes approximately 2,300 head of fed cattle every day was being placed up for sale. At the moment, everything is continuing. Feeder cattle, our fed cattle are going into the plant. They're processing it. Everything remains the same, but the markets have certainly responded in a negative fashion from this announcement coupled with some other news in the market. And we've seen a pretty sharp drawback, pullback on the futures with quite a bit of uncertainty knowing what the next step is.
Well, I mean, Jack, it's not that unusual that they would still be operating, because if you want to sell a business, you don't shut the business down, because a non-operating business, I would guess, is not worth nearly as much as an operating business. So they'll keep it running, but it doesn't mean that necessarily it'll stay running if somebody else decides to buy it. Am I right?
I can't argue with the word you said. You're correct.
So what does it mean for all of us, and why is this happening, and who do we pin the blame on?
Well, I don't know if there's a single person or entity to pin the blame on. We're kind of at the middle of a perfect storm. We've got a U.S. cattle supply that's at a near 75-year record low, and that's been driven by an exceedingly higher age of producers. We've got we've had nationwide droughts that have forced reductions across the country. We're in an area now where we are traditionally short fed cattle supply to maintain the two plants. So normally this Pasco plant would receive fed cattle from around the Pacific Northwest and throughout Canada to offset shortfalls in supply. The benefit that we have is that we're one day closer to the Pacific Rim going out of the Port of Seattle. We've got a little bit of a jump on some of our trading partners here domestically, but the challenge that we look at is the packing industry has faced some pretty significant losses across the board, and Tyson in their announcement was looking to try to consolidate in their kind of cattle-dense areas in Texas, and this plant in Washington was kind of out there on its own. My hope, obviously, is that we see a buyer come forward, and they come forward soon, because the last thing we need is the fear of uncertainty and or not knowing what's going to happen, because our next closest plant, should something happen here, is Hiram, Utah, and that's 8 to 9 hours on a truck, added freight, and things get pretty expensive.
So you've got to take fed cattle and load them on a truck and drive them 10 hours down to Utah to get them to the next closest plant?
Well, the other plant would be the Washington Agribeef, Washington Beef Facility, but they wouldn't be able to accommodate their kill plus the 2,300 head that were going through the Tyson Fresh Meats plant. So there would definitely be cattle that would have to move out of the region to be harvested.
Okay, so
at a significant cost to cattle feeders and eventually all the way down the line.
So, Jack, tell my audience, why is the plant up for sale? Is it up for sale because under the current conditions in the state of Washington, they cannot make the plant operate at a profit? And are those conditions likely to change?
Well, I wish I would have been a fly on the wall to to be able to answer more of those detailed questions. But I think as we look at this, there's clearly some regulatory expenses that food processors face in Washington State that our neighbors don't have. And one of the most important things you look at, B&O tax, that was the last thing that had been done about 20 years ago. There had been a sunset on B&O taxes for beef processors back in the early 2000s. But that had gone away. We've got a variety of other regulatory challenges and costs that drive our cost of operation up here. The benefit that we have and why things look, I think, promising for the facility in the future is we've got everything we need to maintain a viable facility in terms of strong cattle feeding throughout the basin. We've got food processing that helps in providing some additional feed sources. There's a variety of inputs that we can source very locally with very minimal freight. Once we start to look outside of the region and you have to put wheels under things, it becomes much less profitable and more challenging for people to see certainty.
Jack, I want you to, there's a statement put out by Save Family Farming, which is a group I think well of, but they say that Washington state leaders have had a big hand in making this one of the most expensive places in America to grow food. Is that accurate?
Yes, sir. I mean, look at it from the ground up. I mean, we've got a 40-hour minimum wage. We have a 40-hour ag overtime. We've got one of the highest minimum wages in the country. One of the challenges when you look at that, the way with our ag overtime and even with our wages, an ag operation in Washington State doesn't even have the opportunity to be credited for providing things such as housing, transportation, electricity, and in many cases, beef or food or allowances to their employees. So there's a pretty significant amount of benefits that don't get calculated into the overall compensation package of an employee. And as a result, that threshold for the salary, with air quotes, salary exemption from overtime is rapidly approaching $80,000 to $95,000. And if you look at an ag operation, that's getting to be a pretty significant chunk when we've only got so many opportunities to create revenue. It gets very difficult.
It sounds like it. That's Jack Field. Jack is executive director of the Washington Cattle Feeders Association. Back in a moment. You got the Lars Larson Show. Parking lot industrial.
Local, national, Lars has you covered. Call in from anywhere. 866-HEY-LARS. Now, back to the Lars Larson Show.
Hey, welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Imagine this. How much more morbid can social media get when it comes to children? Would you believe baby-canceled abortion announcements are now being praised? Let me get into the details of that in a moment. First, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. Glad to get your phone calls and emails. If you want to jump into what we have always called the best conversation in talk journalism, it's here every day at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@larslarson.com. Now, social media and especially communications like email and text messaging. It has been controversial for decades because people being fired by text message, not exactly a classy act. But consider this. Imagine canceling a baby over social media. Calling off a baby shower on Instagram. Yeah, you could see somebody announcing we were going to have a baby shower. Now we're not going to have a baby shower. I could see that. But calling off the baby itself. Now, the story is out of the New York Post, America's oldest newspaper. And they said a woman who calls herself Mora, M-O-R-A-A, Mora, posted a baby termination announcement that was, well, she's got a whole firestorm of debate. Consider what she says in it. Due date, April 14th, 2027, about 7 months from now, mommy changed her mind, daddy wasn't, and then she used a word I can't use on the radio. The unapologetic advisory, as the Times reports, or the Post reports it, made complete with itty-bitty infant shoes, alphabet blocks, spelling out B-A-B-Y, and a fake-looking ultrasound snapshot. 121,000 likes online, largely from fans who are applauding the would-be mommy for sparing herself and her fetus from a lifetime of strife. In other words, she didn't like the father of her child. She apparently slept with him. She apparently got pregnant by him. But then she decided daddy isn't blank, and so she's simply going to cancel the baby. Now imagine this. One of her supporters said, it ain't never been smart to bring kids into a world of chaos. Good for you. Laugh out loud. And another one said, wish more women were like this. It's called intelligence. But other people described it as sick, blank as blank, and disturbingly vile. A baby is not a dinner reservation that you cancel because you changed your mind. If you know you don't want a child, condoms and birth control exist. Turning an ultrasound and a due date into a cute little canceled photo shoot for Instagram is disturbing as hell. Yeah, disturbing. Now, some are saying, well, maybe it was fake. And the woman is now saying, no, it's not real. She's now claiming that it was fake. But I guess my question would be this. How many times do people simply cancel a baby out of their own convenience? Oh, that's with my old boyfriend. I find that baby inconvenient, so they decide to cancel it. Well, in American culture, about 1 million babies every year are canceled out by mom, usually without saying anything to dad, and I find that especially disturbing. Glad to get your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. Let's start with Ron. Hey, Ron, thanks for listening on our affiliate station, KVI. What's on your mind?
Well, I was listening to you do that breakdown there on the cost of doing business in Washington State, and it occurred to me, we often get on here and we talk about, I've heard you even say it a few times, about if everybody had to pay the taxes at the end of the year at the same time, boy, that would be a wake-up call for people, and anytime somebody wanted to raise taxes, they probably wouldn't allow you to do it. I would suggest that we do the same thing for businesses in states from now on. We either need to come up with a system where we put on the receipt the cost of doing business on every receipt, and at the end of the year, you get to get that smash in your face on a daily basis. You're going to start thinking, hey, maybe this is getting out of control.
I would love that idea because, Ron, the idea you just described, which was my idea a long, long time ago, is that at least once a year, I wish every business in America would simply pay their employees in cash. And what I mean by it is, at the end of the day, you'd be told, okay, this is the week we're going to do the tax exercise. So everybody gets to feel what it's like to actually pay the taxes, because most people, they know what comes in their paycheck. They know what the gross amount was because they can see it on the pay stub. They know what the net amount is, and they don't pay much attention to the money in between. I mean, if somebody was making, say, $3,000 every 2 weeks gross, so $6,000 a month, $72,000 a year, can you imagine if they got an envelope at the end of 2 weeks that had $3,000 in cash, hundreds, fifties, twenties, and tens, and they think, wow, that's a big, thick wad of money. But before they walk out the door from work that night, they get stopped at the first table by a man or a lady who says, okay, I need this much from you for the cost of Social Security. And you start peeling off bills and you pay that. Then they need so much for state taxes, so much for federal taxes, so much for FICA, you know, and FUDA, which is unemployment. And you start peeling off those bills. And by the time you get to the end of all those tables, your $3,000 wad of cash has now turned into $1,900 or $1,800. If everybody had to do that once a year and they actually felt that money leaving their fingertips and going into the hands of the tax man, I think it would make a difference, don't you?
I do. And I, you know, maybe you could go on with people and explain to me and them where did the government get the authority to make everybody in a business to be a tax man?
You mean for withholding on taxes?
Absolutely. Absolutely. That should be banned. We should just.
It's the United States Congress that allowed withholding. And in fact, you know, there's a penalty. If you get to the end of the year, even if you're ready to pay the IRS every dime you owe, they say if you haven't already prepaid through withholding 90% of what you owe at the end of the year, let's say you're going to owe $10,000 in federal taxes at the end of a year, right? You get to the end of the year and you've already had $5,000 taken out. That means you're short on your withholding by at least $4,000. They're going to hit you with a penalty for that. It's going to be a percentage penalty because you were under withheld. And I think they actually began that, I believe, during World War II as a means of financing the war. Because otherwise, you'd get to the end of the year, and whatever it was you owed the government is what you would pay. I think they also realized that if people didn't prepay their federal taxes, they'd get to the end of the year, and they'd say, sorry, Uncle Sugar, I don't have the money to pay you, and you're not going to find it in my bank account, so too bad for you. Ron, thanks so much. I appreciate the call. Back in a moment, you're listening to The Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network.
The Lars Larson Show. Portland's news, traffic, and weather. Follow the Lars Larson Show on X at Lars Larson Show. You never know what he'll post. Now, back to the Lars Larson Show.
Hey, welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. I'm glad to get to your phone calls and emails. It turns out that in some cities, they have decided to create what is called Sharia-compliant lending. And I thought we'd talk about that. In particular, as an example, Seattle, Washington has decided that they are going to provide Sharia-compliant loans. And Shane Harris knows the full nine yards on that. He's editor-in-chief of AMAC Newsline. Hey, Shane, welcome back to the program.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
So would you mind telling my audience, I mean, I guess the short version is that if you're Muslim and you're a devout Muslim, you don't pay interest on loans, which makes it awfully hard to borrow money in America for things like cars or houses, except that now we're seeing governments decide to step in and provide Sharia-compliant lending?
Yeah, that's correct. And first, I just want to give credit to Natalie Winters, a great independent journalist who first broke this story. And we've covered over to AMAC Newsline. And, yeah, so essentially what's going on is these city and state governments are stepping in and they're saying, oh, well, according to the tenets of Sharia law, you're not allowed to charge or pay interest. And so they're creating these special Sharia-compliant loans that implement these convoluted structures for repaying the loans, some sort of fee for the loan. And in some cases, it shakes out to be about the same as interest. But in other cases, not so much. And I think the bigger story here and the thing that Americans should be concerned about is that we now have city and state governments without any input from voters who are making special concessions for what is essentially a Sharia law. It's not just a religious law. It's a political ideology. And they're making special concessions for this political ideology that exists outside the structure of the U.S. Constitution and of the state and local laws that the voters wanted implemented.
Now, Shane, I always tell my audience, in the interest of full disclosure, I'm not a lawyer. That sounds like that would violate the First Amendment to the Constitution, in that the government is not supposed to make any laws or create any structures that have to do with one religion or another religion, that the government is supposed to be neutral toward religion. You can recognize people's God-given right to practice whatever faith they want, but the government is not there to facilitate one above others. And yet it sounds like that's exactly what Seattle and other cities that are doing this are doing, isn't it?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And look, I don't need to be a lawyer to tell you that it seems ridiculous that the Supreme Court and that other Democrat state and local governments are banning people from praying in schools, are banning schools from holding prayer clubs or Bible clubs. Yet they're still coming out and saying, oh, we're going to have these Sharia compliant loans. And, you know, I think it just flies in the face of everything that the Constitution and the First Amendment stands for. And you know, when it comes to the First Amendment, you know, it's something that hasn't always been applied fairly, I think, to Christian groups and entities, but now we're getting special carve-outs for Islamic groups. And by the way, it's not like all Muslims ascribe to Sharia law. There are many Muslims who would tell you they want nothing to do with Sharia law. It's actually what they fled in countries like Iraq and Afghanistan. So the fact that we're seeing it take foothold here in the United States is very concerning.
Well, and what does it say when Seattle, Washington, as a city government, creates an official action item called Housing Tools for Sharia Compliant Lending, and then committed the city to expanding access and even budgeted, some amount of money to make all this happen? So you would think that somebody would have filed a complaint and said, you can't do this. It crosses the First Amendment line. Have they?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, with Seattle specifically, it just speaks to how far gone Seattle is. And by the way, just a quick historical note, there are certain passages in the Bible that have been interpreted as prohibiting Christians from either charging or yep. paying interest. But at no point in American history has there ever been a similar movement to have a special carve out for Christian groups. And so I just think it speaks to a double standard there that you see in Seattle and these other Democrat run cities.
Well, and Shane, I'm a Protestant Christian, and I'm well aware that a technical reading of the Bible says you're not supposed to charge interest, although I think most of that is applied to your close family as opposed to strangers, but it hasn't been a common practice for a long, long time to avoid the payment of interest, although I can remember at least a couple of pieces of fiction, a book or two that I've read and a movie or two that I've seen that depicted Christian societies in America from hundreds of years ago who actually practiced, you know, said we're not going to charge interest or allow members of our group to charge interest on loans. Okay, fine. That's your choice as individuals. It can't be your choice as a government, though, can it?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And, you know, there's another factor at play here, which is, you know, we in the United States, we don't have an official religion, but I think you and I would both agree that this is an overwhelmingly Christian country.
Oh, yeah.
Our founders founded this nation on Christian principles. It's the predominant cultural values that most Americans live by today, whether they're practicing Christians or not. And so to have, groups of people come in here and try to impose their cultural values and mores on whether it be the financial system, the school system, the governmental system, the institutions that the founders of this country created, I think it's very concerning, and it's something that whether you're in one of these Democrat-run cities or not, it's something you need to pay attention to, because what we've seen in the past is that what starts in the Democrat-run cities eventually leaks out to the suburbs and then to the rural areas as well.
Yeah, and I think that's what's going on here. I mean, for Muslims to say, well, our religious practices say we're not allowed to pay interest, so because we live in your society, we're demanding that you, the government, create a special way for us to work around paying interest so that we can pay the money but not call it interest and still be able to purchase a home or a car or have business loans or whatever it is that they're doing. You know, I think the government should say nope. We are agnostic toward that. We're not going to help you. We're not going to hold you back. But it's not the government's job to step in and favor one religion over another.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And if you were to put the shoe on the other foot, imagine an American or somebody from a Western nation moved to a Muslim-majority nation and started charging people interest. I mean, can you imagine the outrage? The left would be screaming about cultural appropriation and violating the customs and the norms and all of that. But yet we're supposed to be completely fine with it here. And I just think it's a completely ridiculous double standard.
Well, I'll tell you what, I'm going to make it probably one of our X polls in the future. That Shane Harris, Shane is the editor-in-chief of AMAC Newsline. And the question comes down to this. If you're going to live in the United States of America and you have the God-given right to practice whatever faith you want or no faith at all, if you have that kind of freedom safeguarded by the first 10 amendments of the U.S. Constitution, the so-called Bill of Rights, if you have that, is it appropriate for any one group to say now the government must create a special way for us to do a workaround on the subject of paying interest on loans? I don't think it is. And in fact, we might just make that one of our X polls going forward. Shane, thanks very much. I appreciate the time. Glad to get your calls. If you want to join what we call the best conversation in talk journalism, it's here every day at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. And you're listening to the Radio Northwest Network. Hips or shoulders.
Take a peek inside Lars's studio. Follow him on Instagram at the Lars Larson Show. Now, more with Lars Larson.
Hey, welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It is a pleasure to be with you on a Monday. If you want to join the best conversation in talk journalism, it's here every day at 866-HEY-LARS. And if you're a naysayer, we put naysayers always right to the head of the line at 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. And Beverly is a naysayer. So Beverly, we've always held to that rule. We've never deviated from it. So since you're a naysayer, welcome to the program. What do you and I disagree about that makes you one?
Oh, thank you, Lars. I believe in religious freedom. It doesn't matter if somebody doesn't like it. I mean, there are people out there that don't want somebody to wear a T-shirt that says Jesus loves you or, you know, any different religion. And you can't just pick one and say, well, they're covering their face, so they shouldn't be allowed to do that. You do that, and then the next step, they're going to take away head coverings for Christians and Jews. And then they're going to take away wearing a cross.
Oh, hold on. Who is? I want to know who they is, Beverly, because you know who the First Amendment applies to. It does not apply. For instance, I could tell, I don't, but I could tell my two great producers, Mackenzie and Joel, I could say, I want neither one of you to mention religion at work. Now, I don't have a foolish rule like that, but I could. And if they said, well, we have the First Amendment freedom to speak about our religion, I said, you're at a private workplace. I'm not constrained by the First Amendment. The U.S. government is constrained. State governments are constrained. But individual private companies are not. So who is the they that would take away somebody's right to wear a Jesus shirt, for example?
Okay, who is the they that wants to take away the right for a face covering?
Well, in the case of the example I gave was Portugal. And what I asked in the X-poll question was, Portugal has now banned face coverings in public. And that ban comes from the president of the country. Now, Portugal is not the United States. And I said, should America follow Portugal's lead and ban face coverings in public? And I even said, I don't know that you'd be able to do it because of the limits of the First Amendment. But a private company could certainly do it. Your bank could say, you're invited to come into our bank. You cannot walk into the bank with a face covering that covers your entire face. Because you're unidentifiable. Does that make sense?
My thing would be then, no, I do not think the U.S. should follow their lead because I think it is a religious right. And once you start taking one away, the rest of them will follow.
It's an interesting slippery slope argument. I don't necessarily believe or agree with it. But then what do you do when this person is in public and they're driving a car, let's say, and wearing a hijab or a burqa, and you cannot see their face? Does law enforcement have a right to identify people when there is a traffic stop and to ask for the driver's license, picture ID, and be able to assert, identify the driver of that car as an identified driver? How do you do that if the driver's entire face is covered?
That's a good question, but
in that case,
did they do it during COVID? People wore those masks.
I think they asked people
COVID.
To pull the mask down so you could see who they were.
Well, I guess you would be able to do that for a split second and allow them to put them right back on.
Yes, you could. And in fact, what you'd be doing is there are a lot of people, Beverly, who call this show who believe that the Bill of Rights is absolute and that is. You cannot have exceptions to it. That's wrong. The courts have always recognized that constitutional rights are subject to time, place, and manner restrictions. For example, you're exercising your First Amendment right to free speech right now, aren't you?
Yes.
Okay, what if you decided to go exercise your right to free speech by getting a bullhorn and standing outside of a hospital or a nursing home and using the bullhorn at 3 a.m. to read the Constitution or the Declaration of Independence? Do you imagine the police might have something to say to you?
Well, yeah, then you are disrupting the community.
Yeah, it'd be called creating a public disturbance, disturbing the peace, that sort of thing. That's an example of a time, place, or manner restriction that applies to all constitutional rights. There are people who think the Second Amendment is absolute. It's not, because we have laws that say if you're a convicted felon, you can't buy a gun. Well, that's clearly a limitation on the Second Amendment, but it's based on a specific need to say we don't want, say, convicted murderers or convicted rapists to get a gun.
Correct.
Yeah.
I just think that the whole burqa thing, that would be a slippery slope, and once you allow it on one thing, they'll just start whittling away.
Yeah. What I'm concerned with is, what if you can't identify who's under that covering? So if you worked in a bank as a teller, would you be okay with customers walking in with their whole head covered so you have no way to identify them? Because I know that even before the Islam issue came up, I've had banks where I've done business where they said, please take off your ball cap and your sunglasses when you walk into the bank. You think that's reasonable? Because I do.
I do, but they didn't do it during COVID. People were allowed to wear masks during COVID. It's just, this is a religious thing.
Yep.
Instead of the government telling you to wear one, now it's a religious thing so that, you know, people aren't for it.
Yeah, and that's a very good point. I don't entirely disagree with you, Beverly. Let me make that clear, but I don't entirely agree with you either. By the way, my favorite email of the day so far, brought to you by Multnomah Medical Clinic. No pills, no shots, no surgery. Fix what's actually causing the problem at Multnomah Medical Clinic. Roger writes in, regarding the hundreds of thousands of dollars offered up by the mayor of Portland to attract businesses to locate in downtown Portland, which is in sad shape right now. He says, Lars, you got to love the mayor and Mayor Wilson's new incentives for downtown business to improve their stores. What an idiot. How about we give that money to the police and let them enforce the law? Sweep up the homeless, the drug users, arrest the protesters and the vandals. Nobody wants to improve their business, only to have it destroyed by those we don't enforce or have the resources to enforce the law. First things first, clean up the crime. Otherwise, we're just once again putting perfume on a pig. Signed, Roger Burson. Roger, I think you're absolutely right. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show, and this segment brought to you by NickShivers.com. That's NickShivers.com.
The Lars Larson Show.
It's no
FM News.
In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Live. This
is the Lars Larson Show.
President Trump is one badass president. He secured the border at a level we've never seen before.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
For our country and for our children, the best is yet to come.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
He is an existential threat to democracy.
Here's your host.
Quiet, please.
Lars Larson.
Hey, welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to get to your phone calls and emails. We'll do that in just a moment, but I want to first talk to Jonathan Simons, who is a pastor at South Lake Church in Lake Oswego. Jonathan, welcome to the program, and thanks so much for taking the time.
Hey, Lars. Thanks for having me. Excited to be here.
In the interest of full disclosure, I've always told people that I think eminent domain is something that's absolutely necessary to the operation of the United States. However, do I think it's overused by the government? Do I think the government frequently goes out and tries to take away land or property from people without really good cause, but simply because a given government wants the property? In fact, some of the most famous cases, the Kelo case, went all the way to the Supreme Court to determine can a government simply take a piece of property from individual owners because it would return more property taxes to the government that's taking the land. And I thought that one was especially ridiculous, but yours comes very close to being as bad. You're literally in a church that you and your congregation bought not too long ago, and now the local school board is trying to tear that property away from you?
I mean, yeah, you're basically summarizing it correctly, but I do want to say just from the jump that we don't see the district or the school board as enemies. We have a long history of partnering with school districts. I mean, we're a church across the street from a high school, and ultimately we felt like we purchased our home to serve the community and serve the school district and serve the students of the high school that's across the street.
Well, I understand you want to stay on good terms with them, and I have no objection to that. I think that's a good idea. But what is the reason that the school district has decided that it absolutely has to have your property that you just finished purchasing, which the school district could have purchased on the private marketplace at the same time you did, couldn't they?
Yeah. Actually, they were one of the competing offers in the open market. Ultimately, the seller chose to enter into an agreement with us to purchase the property. We went through with it, purchased the property. We began gathering there. We began hosting, you know, ministry events and began serving the community. And then we invested a significant amount, or are investing a significant amount of resources to continue to invest into the community. And it hopefully, God willing, it being our forever home. But you would ask, Lars, you know, what purposes are they interested in the property? One of the critical things that the district brought up was parking. That neighborhood is pretty tight with parking, and this would open up some parking for their community. And we entered into a formal agreement with the school to make available the vast majority of our parking lot to the school, to the students, for free, part in which the district charges students to use that parking lot. And so we have that agreement already in place. They're also wanting to expand some educational use. I think it's for their CTP program, which is for 18 to 21-year-olds who need some additional assistance transitioning into adulthood. And we have... We've opened up to them and said, hey, we'd love to talk about what collaboration could look like, shared space could look like.
And the district isn't willing to let it go at that? They want the title to the property anyway?
That's what it appears that they want. They want ownership of the property is what it appears. So we haven't our big posture, our big big request is that we would stay at the table to continue to talk and see how this relationship could grow so that we can both serve the families that we're meant to serve. They are right now wanting to negotiate not for collaboration but for ownership of the property. And
let's stay at the table, let's negotiate this out. And the district said, no, forget that. We're just going to take your property. I mean, I feel like characterizing it that way. Is that a proper characterization?
I can see how some people could come to that conclusion, yes. We're not there now. They haven't filed officially for eminent domain, but the school board has approved the district to use eminent domain if negotiations fail. And what it appears to be so far is that negotiations are more monetary than it is collaborative.
Now, hold on. By that, you mean what? What does it mean that it's monetary instead of collaborative?
That so far it appears that their posture is they would like the property, they'd like ownership, they'd like title to the property, is what it appears so far. Again, we're not there yet, and we haven't crossed that bridge yet.
I mean, maybe, I hate to characterize it this way, but this is Lake Oswego, after all, one of the most affluent communities in the Pacific Northwest. So they've got so much money that even when you say to them, we'll let you use the parking lot free of charge, we'll let you use some of the facility for these things involving students with developmental disabilities up to age 21, we'll work with you on all of that, and you won't have to buy it. And Lake Oswego's school board says, no, we're going to spend the money. We want to buy the property, even if we've got, you know, the uses out of it that we've already said, these are the reasons we want to have the property. You're giving them that, and they're saying, no, that's not good enough. We want to own it.
Yeah, their stated goals are very public and very available. During the school board meeting, they had mentioned part of it was they had plans to do some of this stuff already on owned property, either through renovations or expansions. But when this became available on the public market, and then, of course, when the seller chose us, they chose to pivot towards eminent domain to keep us talking. And really to keep an option available for them to take ownership of the property. Yeah, that's correct.
So they already have property they could do this same activity on for the 18 to 21 year olds, for the parking and everything else. They have the facility to do it, but they want your property too? That seems awfully greedy to
me. You know, I don't know those details. I'm not, you know, a real estate agent. I'm not a broker. I'm not a representative for the district. I don't know what they have available. I can only say what they had mentioned during the public school board meeting, that there were plans, but when this property became available, the plans changed. And then once we closed on the deal, the plans evolved.
And why didn't they make a better offer than yours?
You know, I don't know. I don't know exactly why the seller chose us. What I do know is that we were moving pretty quick. We were moving pretty efficiently, and we really felt like God was leading us to this property. And so when this property became available, we jumped on it. We brought a strong offer in. We a quick close. I do want to say they did, this is available publicly, but they did offer 4% more in price for the property, but I think the seller, there were some other levers that the sellers just chose to go with us.
Yeah, well, there's nothing wrong with that, because the seller can sell to who they want to. That's Jonathan Simons, who is a pastor at South Lake Church in Lake Oswego, and the Lake Oswego School Board wants to take their property, and they threaten to use eminent domain to do it. You've got the Lars Larson Show. Right now, you might find.
This is your home for honestly provocative talk radio. The truth every day. Now, back to the Lars Larson Show.
Hey, welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. I'm glad to get to your phone calls and emails at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. It seems that there is a popularity for what they call millionaire's taxes around the United States of America. I mean, Zohran Mamdani has one effective millionaire's tax. That's on second homes in New York City. You've got California that's going after billionaires and multi-millionaires. And then you've got the state of Washington, which is going after a so-called millionaire's tax, which nobody expects that millionaire's tax is going to stay restricted only to those who make over $1 million a year. They very much suspect that that is where they will start, but that it will quickly move downward the same way the United States income tax began a little over 100 years ago, and then within about 7 or 8 years became a tax not on the super rich and not a very small tax, but a large tax on the not so super rich. But let me dig into that in a moment. First, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to get to your phone calls and emails at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. And our ex-poll question today, should America follow Portugal's lead and ban face coverings in public? The president of Portugal, a guy by the name of Antonio José Segura, has enacted a measure that largely prohibits individuals, most of them Muslims, from covering their faces while in public, a restriction broadly aimed at Muslim women in particular. The law bans sporting coverings meant to cover a person's face or block identification in public areas, and bans requiring someone to cloak their face because of gender, religion, age, or origin. Those who fail to comply with the rules could be slapped with fines of 150 to up to 3,000 euros. You can find today's ex-poll question, should America follow Portugal's lead and ban face coverings in public? I'd answer that one yes. You can answer it any way you like. You'll find the question at Lars Larson Show on X. You'll also find it on our website at LarsLarson.com. But what is happening now that millionaires' taxes are becoming very popular with various states around America? And they come in a variety of different forms. Well, the end result is the destruction they wreak actually begins before the first of those taxes are collected. Let me give you an example out of the state of Washington, which has a brand new millionaires tax. It is being tested by a public vote. It is being tested in court. It may or may not be successful. It's not even due to be collected until about 3 years from now in 2029. But already there is a Seattle architecture firm that says concern over the proposed millionaires tax is already causing wealthy clients to cancel some of their major projects. The organization is called AOME. It's an architecture firm owned by a guy by the name of Mark Elster. And he says that this millionaire's tax, he says the message is that it's going to chill economic growth, and that if it survives on the ballot this November, the almost 10% tax on any household or individual making more than $1 million will be collected starting in 2029. It is expected to generate about $4 billion a year for the state government. Now, this is a state government, by the way, that has increased taxes more than 100% in just the last decade or so. They say the tax is needed because the state government never gets tired of spending people's money. But even though they haven't collected it yet, the owner of this architecture firm says it is driving a business decrease across the construction industry, especially for high-end home construction. Here's the quote from Mark Elster. They're all reporting some anecdotal evidence of a chill in client activity. The number of projects going on and the projects being canceled after they've already been started. They said that they have lost the largest project that they had in their office because the client said there are concerns over this millionaire tax. Hundreds of people tied to that project have already been impacted. That means people are losing their jobs. And they say the revenue for this big architecture firm has already dropped by more than 50% in the last several months. They've had to lay off employees. And this Mark Elster, who owns AOME Architects, says he wants to raise public awareness because of the direct impact, especially on businesses and average workers, saying the people impacted in various fields tied to construction are most definitely not millionaires. He said, I wish those lawmakers had a better practice of consulting the folks who are impacted by this, the stakeholders, and learning about the second and third order impacts before they put legislation like this in place. So do I think that government pays attention to what is going on in the economy when they pass these kinds of taxes? I don't think they do. And I'll remind you one more time. Go back just over 100 years ago to the creation of America's income tax in about 1912. And you say, well, what does that have to do with today? Consider what happened then. They passed an income tax. They promised that it would only be on the super wealthy. It did not apply to average folks in America a little over 100 years ago. How long did it take before they started to tax average folks? About 7 or 8 years. All they needed was to get the camel's nose under the edge of the tent. And once they got that camel's nose under the tent, it was game over. Today, America's income tax applies to everybody who makes a paycheck. Now, they've made it somewhat progressive. That means richer people are going to pay a higher percentage, and people who are poorer pay a lower percentage. But the bottom line is, it was promised to be a tax on the very, very super wealthy to begin with. The average person in America at the time made about $500 a year as their in their regular paycheck. The tax only applied if you made over $3,000 a year. So in other words, it only applied to people who made six times as much as the average person. As I said, that didn't last for long. It was very quickly changed by the United States Congress, where they said, no, we're going to apply the tax to just about everybody, and everybody is going to pay. Well, the fact is, an awful lot of people do pay the income tax today, but it started as a tax only on the super wealthy. Time to get your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. You can vote in our X poll. You'll find the X poll question at Lars Larson Show and at LarsLarson.com. Is Donald Trump's trade war with Canada spiraling out of control? That's coming up next on the Radio Northwest Network.
The Lars Larson Show. Portland's news traffic. The Lars Larson Show today? Find Lars's thoughts and get the podcast right now at LarsLarson.com. Now, here's Lars Larson.
Hey, welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. So Donald Trump just slapped Canada with 50% tariffs, and Canada says it will retaliate dollar for dollar. Is this how Donald Trump gets a better deal, or American wallets about to take a hit? I thought we'd consult with Alan Sanders, who is an attorney, former Time Magazine senior reporter, and professor emeritus of political science at St. Peter's University. Professor Sanders, welcome back.
Thank you, Lars.
What do you read in all of this back and forth between Trump and the Canadians?
Well, I read that Donald Trump really is bent on tariffs. I mean, it's sort of one-note Donnie. The key to success, according to Donald Trump, but the record shows that he backs down when he sees that the United States is going to be hurt more than he anticipates, or his advisors tell him that this will be not very good for the elections coming up in November. He backs down. You know, the Wall Street has coined a term for this, a taco. Trump always chickens out, and it tends to happen on Tuesdays. So we're on Monday today. Tomorrow is Tuesday. We will see what he does. But he does seem to be really on his tariff crusade, and he doesn't really want to deviate from it, despite the evidence that prices go up when tariffs are imposed on foreign states. But it doesn't seem to deter him. This seems to be something that's been in his spirit for a long time.
Okay, but Professor Sanders, isn't that the way all negotiations go to some extent? I mean, depending on how tough a negotiator you are, if you're going to buy anything, if you're going to buy a house, if you're going to buy a car, if you're negotiating for almost anything, one side or the other will choose to say, either give me my price or I'm walking away from the table. And the other side is free to do the same. Doesn't that generically describe just about any kind of negotiation?
Sure. You come in with a position and you say, this is what I want, this is what I need, and you always ask for more than you're actually going to get. But let's not forget that Trump has imposed tariffs for all kinds of things and for all kinds of reasons, not necessarily economic reasons, reasons that have to do with politics or with a country's orientation or with what he believes is, you know, not in the interest of the United States. It's tariffs, tariffs, tariffs. And for many people, I think the message has come down to the fact that tariffs are really taxes on Americans. They don't really impose any economic harm on a foreign state, other than it hurts their industries. But who pays for the tariffs? It's not the foreign country. It's the American consumer. So I think what's really clear is that the message has gotten down to the voters. And for Trump, one of the problems is that, you know, affordability is a big issue. And for consumers, it doesn't really matter whether the tariff is aimed at Canada or another country. Most people won't really realize which country is being targeted here. All they know is that goods are expensive, and then when they hear tariffs, they'll simply assume that, okay, something is going to go up again, whether it's Canadian or not, or whether the tariffs aimed at Canada or not. They'll just say, oh, dear, here goes another increase in goods that we need to purchase.
I'm talking to Professor Alan Sanders, who's an attorney, former Time Magazine senior reporter, and professor emeritus of political science at St. Peter's University. When he first began using, and this seems like a long time ago, but it was really just about a little over a year and a half ago, there was also a suggestion that imposing those tariffs might actually create new American marketplaces where companies would be able to compete. Has there been any sign that that has developed?
I'm not aware of any, but again, I'm not an economist, so I can't swear to it, but I'm not aware of any. Certainly in the manufacturing field, Trump promised a great increase in manufacturing in the United States. I don't think that has happened. But I'd like to add another thing about what's going on with Canada. Canada has not only said that it would respond dollar for dollar, as you pointed out just a moment ago, but some Canadian politicians have actually said that the tariff war would actually escalate into boycotts. That is to say, withholding certain goods from coming into the United States that the United States actually relies on, such as electricity and certain kinds of lumber. So what you really got is not just the question of whether this will escalate into dollar for dollar, but whether it will actually escalate into withholding of goods that the United States relies on. That is to say, withholding the goods from the United States. Let's not forget, however, having said all that, that whatever manifestations this tariff conflict takes between the United States and Canada, Canadians will suffer as well. So it's not just something that will impose, cost on the United States or the withholding of goods. And so if you get into this kind of situation, it will simply, not simply, but it may likely be whoever blinks first, whoever gets hurt the most, and whoever believes that they have to come back to the negotiating table first.
So, Professor, I'm talking to Professor Alan Sanders from the St. Peter's University. What do you think his real agenda is, then? Are we not determining it? Are we not able to discern what his real agenda is?
Well, it's not clear because it doesn't seem to have done very much for the American economy. He has believed that tariffs somehow help strengthen the U.S. economy because it helps domestically those industries that face unfair competition from abroad.
Yeah.
But the economy right now is not doing so well, in part because some of these tariffs are not necessarily targeted by the economics of the situation, but rather by the president's political instincts or his political revenge against countries that he believes are not cooperating strategically or politically or internationally with the U.S. interests. So it seems to be, to me, that it's a set of tariffs that are mostly politically motivated rather than economically motivated. If they were economically motivated, then they might be more tailored and perhaps less disruptive to the American economy.
Okay, but should they always be just about the economy, or should some of it be about communicating America's foreign policy toward countries, both our allies and others?
But there are many other ways to do that besides hurting the American economy. You can talk. You can engage in diplomatic talks with other countries. You can suggest things below the public, radar and indicate below the public pronouncements that this is what you want and this is what you may do or you might do. Trump has been very much outspoken and, will tell countries and insult countries, rather, not just tell them, but insult countries directly and then tack on a tariff. And that doesn't help your diplomatic initiatives. I mean, I should point out that the Europeans don't like, the way Trump has treated them. And our strategic interests with the Europeans, with countries in Asia, and with countries here in the Americas, Canada being, of course, one of the primary ones, have different.
Well, and that's, as far as I'm concerned, I'm glad to see that Trump is negotiating in public and letting us all know where he's going. Professor, thanks. One in currency, but...
Lars Larson wants to hear from you, even if you disagree. Naysayers get to cut the line at 866-HEY-LARS. Now, here's Lars Larson.
Hey, welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. I think if you listen to this show, you know my point of view when it comes to vote by mail. Do I have to vote by mail? Yes, I do, because the state I live in has vote by mail and has for a couple of decades. State of Oregon, where I used to live, had vote by mail. Do I think that vote by mail is a colossal disaster? Yes, I do. Do I agree with Jimmy Carter, the former president of the United States, in his conclusion that vote by mail affords the greatest opportunity for election fraud that exists anywhere in America's electoral system? I do. Jimmy Carter and I agree on that. So when Donald Trump came in and said, look, vote by mail is a mess. We're going to start restricting vote by mail. We're going to tell the U.S. Postal Service you may only deliver mail ballots to people who have, who have met the requirements, that you have to be an American citizen, that you have to show that you've got picture ID, et cetera, et cetera. Well, the Supreme Court has just come down with a decision in which it sides with the Trump administration. That just happened today within the last couple of hours. In a case over President Donald Trump's executive order that restricts mail-in voting, although they say it remains unclear how much of this can be implemented before the midterm elections happen. The decision leaves room for additional court challenges that could further slow down Donald Trump's order. Yeah, probably. The U.S. Postal Service has already laid out how it would implement the order. They did that last week. But time is running short to impose major changes, with some states beginning to send mail ballots to voters in the next couple of weeks. The court's conservative majority, by the way, this is a key part of this, did not decide the legality of Trump's order. Instead, they simply said the states do not have a legal right to challenge it. In a lot of ways, this makes me very, very happy, because the left, usually liberals in this country, love process. They will say, well, procedurally, you may be right, you may be wrong, but if you didn't get it right procedurally, we're going to deny you the win. In this case, it turns out that Donald Trump gets the win. Why? Because the states did not have the legal right to challenge what he was doing. They said the court's disposition of this application does not mean that any measure taken by the government to implement the order, that's the executive order from Trump, will necessarily be lawful. On that score, time will tell. Now, the majority wrote that in an unsigned order. The Supreme Court's three liberal-leaning justices dissented. Mail balloting, and God bless Donald Trump for this, has been a favorite target for Donald Trump, who has claimed that it breeds fraud. It does. And despite strong evidence to the contrary. Now, they say strong evidence to the contrary. There's no evidence that mail voting is legitimate at all. I've pointed out to you 100 times that the problem with mail voting is you have no idea, when you send that ballot out 3 weeks before an election, who the ballot actually arrives at. And when it's voted and then sent back, you have almost no way to determine whether or not there was chain of custody, meaning do you know who actually voted the ballot? You don't. It's one of the reasons that the left loves vote by mail, because it affords the greatest opportunity for voting fraud. And you say, well, Lars, who believes that? Well, among other people, Jimmy Carter, who headed up a presidential commission on the subject of voting fraud. They said the case may be one of multiple voting-related challenges coming before the U.S. Supreme Court. The Justice Department has filed an emergency appeal asking the High Court to allow work on implementing the changes before the midterm elections. And that's where it becomes very, very critical. Should we say you're only going to mail ballots to people where we can actually prove that person is a citizen and has a right to cast a ballot? There are Democrat officials in 23 states that have sued to block the order. And why those 23 states? Because they're the Democrat majority states. They're the so-called blue states in America. And they hate the idea of letting Donald Trump do anything, even if it actually makes the voting system more secure. What did the attorneys write? The consequences of allowing such transformative changes to take effect so close to the fall elections would be extreme. You know why? Because the folks on the Democrat side of the aisle, we've played the sound bites for you, have already said without vote by mail and without illegal aliens, we can't win elections on the left. That is the conclusion of the Democrat Party. So they got a couple of problems they're working on. Number one, an awful lot of their illegal alien voters have already been shipped out of the United States, several million of them. And then you've got the problem that if Donald Trump gets in the way of vote by mail, which is the left's other favorite way to cheat, that that's going to be blocked as well. A judge in Massachusetts had blocked the plan for the midterm elections in those states. Appeals courts upheld her order, but now the U.S. Supreme Court has ruled otherwise. The Justice Department appealed to the Supreme Court. They made the appeal in late July, and here we are on the 24th of August. And they have said, you can go ahead and do it. The states don't have a right to challenge it. They pointed out another ruling out of Washington where a judge allowed Donald Trump's order to proceed. Federal attorneys argued that the Massachusetts order blocks the government's ability to finalize and implement the president's policies to promote election integrity. Now, what do I think needs to happen? I think the Congress needs to pass the SAVE Act. Not that that would be done soon enough to affect this year's election. But at the very least, Donald Trump is fighting on this one. And this is one where other Republicans have simply given up. Because Donald Trump has blamed vote by mail for his loss to Democrat Joe Biden in 2020. I think there's good evidence of that. And he has promoted the proposed changes as safeguards to keep non-U.S. citizens from voting. And who could argue with that? Do you remember when we've been told over the last several years, there are no foreign nationals voting in American elections, only to find out this year, mostly this year, but a bit of it, we found out last year that there are, in fact, foreign nationals, tens of thousands of them, who are registered to vote in America. There are tens of thousands that have actually cast ballots in United States elections. And this was something the liberal left in America absolutely denied. They said it is not happening. It is not possible. We don't agree with that at all. It simply isn't happening. Well, it turns out it is happening because we've got an awful lot of foreign nationals in this country who've seen fit to register to vote, and the Democrats want to make it possible for them to vote and affect the outcome of our elections. We're not going to let the Democrats win by cheating with illegal foreign national voters. Back in a moment, you're listening to The Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network.
The Lars Larson Show.
FM News 101.